You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest this week is guitarist Jorma Kaukinen, who got his start in the 1960s as the lead guitarist for the Jefferson Airplane. Before we begin our interview, let's listen to the Jefferson Airplane recorded at Woodstock in August of 1969. That was the Jefferson Airplane, recorded at Woodstock in 1969. The lead guitarist is my guest, Jorma Kaukinen. Jorma Kaukinen is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He played lead guitar and was a founding member of Jefferson Airplane. He's also a founding member of Hot Tuna and has had a long solo career with many fine albums. Jorma Kaukinen played at Monterey Pop, Woodstock, and Altamont, and he's just published his memoirs in a book entitled Been So Long, My Life and Music. Jorma Kaukinen, and welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hey, and thanks a lot for having me.
I really enjoyed your book.
Fantastic. Oh, thanks.
I've had a few guests here who've been at Woodstock, and they sort of fall into two categories. Some say it was just another gig, just, you know, one more day. And some say it was awful, and everything about it was horrible. And in your book, you sort of lean toward the just another gig point of view. But a few years ago, I saw this special that had some outtakes from Woodstock, and there's this shot of you, and you look like you were having the time of your life there.
Oh, listen, I mean, first of all, I won't forget where I am. The actual question here, but to back up a little bit about just another gig, or it was horrible, whatever. I mean, on some, I don't think anybody knew what to expect. I mean, for us, certainly, I've never really talked about other Woodstockians about this. And I guess on some level, because we just came from the Atlantic City Pop Festival, we thought, that's another festival, we'll go play it, and then we'll go play another gig. And obviously, when Woodstock evolved in the way that it did, it was anything but another gig, and it's sort of something will never be replicated again. So I guess we could complain about the lack of porta-potties and food, but we could certainly revel in the opportunity that we had to play for 500,000 people. Now, to move on down the line to your question, yeah, I mean, you know, if you think about, I mean, even today, I mean, listen, I'm going to be 78 years old this year, and back then I was in my late 20s. So, you know, to be able to play and have people come to see you at any time is always a good thing. But to be surrounded by the energy that's generated by the sort of, like, moderately controlled chaos that was Woodstock, and to be part of that, what's not to have a good time?
Well, you do. There's photographic evidence of you having a good time, so.
Good.
You know, your book, Been So Long, it's like a Jorma Kaukonen listening party. I mean, you take us through all of your recordings and you talk about each one. But I wanted to hear a little bit more about my personal favorite, which was Quaw, which Grace Slick also admires in her introduction to your book. And there's so many fine songs on the album. So can you talk a little bit about how you came to record that album, and also tell us about that cover image of that record?
Sure. Well, first of all, the cover image was done by my ex-wife, Margareta. And, you know, she was... That's an interesting story. I kind of touched on it in the book. I mean, We got married. We were both pretty young, and she came over from Sweden, where she'd been working a full time job since she was like 15. But she never really got a job like she was a layout artist. She never really got a job like that when she came to the States. But she was always an artist, and she's always doing something. And so, I used a lot of her stuff, not just because she was my wife at the time, but because I really liked what she was doing, and it was so different from any of the other, like, album covers or commercial art or whatever that we did at the time. So she's kept coming up with all this good stuff, and I use it whenever I could. As far as the recording of the album, you know, Margareta, my ex-wife, also plays a huge part of that, too, because a lot of those songs were written in an era when she and I... Because both she and I fooled around and did a lot of stuff that's not good for marriages and whatnot. But right around that time, we decided we were going to get serious about our relationship, which we did for a while. But in any case, and I was just inspired to write all these songs. I was sort of like tuned into that psychological or emotional headspace. And, you know, one of the songs I think that Grace likes, Genesis, it's just one of those songs that I couldn't write a song like that today because I'm not there today. I'm not going through those kind of feelings, you know. As a writer, I'm not a tunesmith. I don't write songs for other people. I write songs when something emotionally kicks me in the butt. And I had been seriously kicked in the butt right around that time. And that song really just came incredibly naturally at one sitting. And I teach songwriting classes also, and I go, you know, that song called on me to write it, and I wrote it. That's not a good way to write songs. You could be waiting a long time for something like that to happen. But in any case... All that stuff that happened in the Crawl record was definitely, you know, tied into what was happening in my psycho-emotional life at the time. The other thing that was really cool was all that, you know, from a recording point of view, this is before we had all the pickups and all these electronic gadgets we plugged acoustic guitars in to make them sound like they're not plugged into anything. And I got a chance, you know, the people I was working with, like Al Schmidt, with RCA, and Betty Cantor, who was a San Francisco recordist at the time, just had golden ears. I mean, you know, even when I was younger and I could hear better, I just didn't hear things in that multidimensional kind of way. And so to be able to work with people like that, they heard a sound that Jack and I were getting from our instruments and were able to record it using the tools of that time. So if you listen to a nice clean vinyl copy of that record, the sound's unbelievable. It's not bad digitally either, but I mean, it was just a perfect storm, a confluence of really amazing events where the technology married to the artists of you know, the recorders that were working at the time, and what Jack and I were doing, and what I was doing as a solo artist, and it just worked.
Well, I did have quite a few years of listening to it on vinyl before I ever found a CD of it.
Right. Well, we couldn't even spell CD in the beginning, could we?
That's right. There's some beautiful string arrangements on that record.
Yeah. Now, Mallory Earle, I can't remember his name because he's so brilliant, but it's on the record. The guy that did the string parts, he and his wife, and it's worth looking at and crediting him. And it's embarrassing. I should remember because the string parts are beautiful. And I remember the time that Mallory wanted to do that, I was very suspicious of doing that because I couldn't hear the possibilities. However, the string parts are beautiful, and there's some French horn stuff in there too. The string parts are beautiful, they're simple, and they enhance rather than take away from what the acoustic guitar did. I could have never come up with that on my own.
That was your first solo record.
How did it happen?
How did you decide, oh, you know, it's time to do a solo record?
Well, we did that. Jack produced the record, and we did that right after the first Hot Tuna record. You know, it was sort of like a golden period for myself as a solo artist and my partnership with Jack at the time, because the Jefferson Airplane had gained, you know, it's hard to stop a train, and the airplane at that time was a very long train, and so we had a lot of energy that the airplane had generated, which allowed, you know, me and Jack as solo artists to really do pretty much what we wanted to do without having RCA, you know, telling us what to do. And so I had an opportunity to do this, and I figured, I mean, I don't know why I thought, why would I rather do this without Jack? I mean, I really don't know, but it just seemed to make sense at the time, and that's how it worked out.
And because of the airplane, you didn't have to, say, pitch a record to a record.
No, exactly. I mean, it, you know, the door was open, we just walked through it. Yeah. I mean, you know, artists today, if you're dealing, you know, with a record company, you have to pitch it, you have to sell them on it, and then you may or may not have to do what they want you to do.
Well, I just happen to love that record. And
oh, thanks.
Thanks for talking about it. You know, your book, and it's called My Life and Music. Been so long, My Life and Music. And naturally, inevitably, death, you know, occurs in your story. So many of your colleagues and friends from the past are no longer with us. And since you wrote the book, Marty Balin has passed away. So
yeah,
I wonder if you wanted to share anything about Marty.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about that is, you know, me and my pals, those of us that are sort of share that collective certain age kind of thing, you know, all of us, we're not fools. We all know that nobody lives forever. But you just never think it's going to happen to you or somebody close to you, you know. I mean, we lost Paul. That was a shock. And it's like, I mean, it was, and then Signe on the same day. I knew that Marty had had some health issues, but I, knowing what a tough, dedicated guy he was in his life, I was sure he's going to surmount them, and that would be that, you know. And so it really came as a great shock to us. And Marty's wife called me and Jack. We were just getting ready to go on stage at the Academy of Music in Northampton, Massachusetts. I'd do a sound check, actually. And we were standing in the wings when we got the call. And I remember thinking at the time, it just made that world seem a little smaller, you know, in a lot of ways. Somebody asked me that what my fondest memory of Marty was, because that's the kind of question people ask you when one of your well-known friends dies.
Yeah.
And my fondest memory of him wasn't so much the stuff we did in the time with the airplane, but it was a couple years ago when he and a couple of his pals came and played my theater at the Purpeach Ranch. And we reconnected as friends way after all that other stuff was over. That meant a lot to me.
Oh, that's great. I mean, he did have such a beautiful voice, didn't he?
I mean, he's one of the great male voices of my time. There's no question about it.
Well, there were some pretty great voices and talents. I mean, it's pretty amazing when you think about the golden age of the Jefferson Airplane. You had so many
absolutely
people. And
I mean, you can't make that stuff up. I mean, I was doing that. You know, I'm doing some interviews today, so I was talking to somebody before I talked to you, and one of the things I was going, you know, I told Grace how fortunate I was last year sometime, that what an honor it was for me to be able to sing with an artist her caliber. We never said stuff like that to each other. But I was able to talk to Marty about that, too. I mean, really, you know, I do some singing, too, but I'm not that singer. For me to be able to play with artists of that caliber, I mean, what a blessing, really.
Talk a little bit about the sound. You know, you mentioned in the book the kind of Rickenbacker guitar birds sound,
right,
which you can really hear on Surrealistic Pillow, on the first track of Surrealistic Pillow.
Right.
Is this a new Birds record? Oh, no, it's not. It's something completely different.
Yeah. Well, that's Paul playing the Rickenbacker there. I only had my Rickenbacker. Maybe it was me. I can't remember. That's a good question. I think it could have been me. Well, Paul, that is really funny stuff, you know, Because I knew David before the Birds, and then the Birds happened, and the Birds, of course, were hugely influential to all of us for a lot of reasons. So Paul, when I was coming to the airplane, Paul's thing was, you got to get a Rickenbacker 12-string. So I cashed in some bonds, and I got one. It was never really my thing, but after the fact, because of what I didn't know about it, I was able to do some stuff that was kind of interesting on it. And in the context of those early albums, I mean, Takes Off is absolutely a folk rock album, and to me, A Surrealistic Pillow is sort of transitional from a folk rock into a rock and roll record. But yeah, the Rickenbacker, I mean, I'm thinking today, you know, I kind of wish I hadn't sold that guitar.
You could probably find another.
Oh, I could, but since, you know, since I'm not really a 12-string player, it just wouldn't have the same emotional content, you know what I mean?
Yeah, to have the same one that you had.
Exactly.
That record, Surrealistic Pillow, I mean, Airplane made a lot of great records, but I think that's the one that sort of stands tall. I mean, I think that's up there with Sgt. Pepper or any of the great records of the era.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, that's true. In a way, and I don't mean to sound like I'm patting myself on the back, I know what you mean, because in that record, it was still about thinking about songs as finite quantities rather than a lot of the stuff we did later on, like After Beating It Back, just really long songs, which was cool, too. Although Sgt. Pepper certainly broke the ground for that kind of stuff also in a lot of ways. But yeah, everything is much more artistically concise in Pillow.
Yeah. The Beatles had an influence on you guys. I mean, you mentioned having Grunt Records because the Beatles had Apple Records, for instance.
Yeah. But, hell, of course. Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Were you listening to a lot of the Beatles then?
You know, interestingly enough, I was never a huge Beatles fan back in the beginning. Although I started the album Revolver, I loved that album. Of course, Sgt. Pepper, we all got into that one. Of the Brit bands, I preferred the Stones because they were closer to the blues rock kind of thing that I liked. However, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is like, you know, on this acid trip that I took back when acid was still legal, I'm driving along in this little car, and this George Harrison solo from She's a Woman comes on the radio, and in that moment, I really got what was going on with not only the Beatles, but rock and roll in general, but the grand epiphany. And looking back on it now, there is no way that the Beatles could not have influenced us. And I remember that David Crosby gave Cantor a reel-to-reel tape of Sgt. Pepper's way before the record came out, and we listened to it relentlessly. I mean, nobody heard anything like that before.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Rock and Roll Hall of Fame lead guitarist Jorma Kaukonen of Jefferson Airplane and Hot Tuna. Well, you just mentioned LSD and an LSD epiphany, and I haven't
heard
that, so I wanted to ask you about that. So,
sure.
You know, you do talk a lot about, you know, about being in recovery and about the drugs and drinking.
Sure.
But LSD is kind of a different realm. You said you take it a few times. So reflect on LSD a little bit. Did it have a lasting effect on you in any way?
That's a good question, I was never really fond of LSD. I mean, in the beginning, I mean, it's a funny stuff. You know, when we first started, you know, getting high, me and my pals back in the, you know, back in the early 60s, there was almost like a shamanistic aspect to it. And again, as an older guy who's in recovery, I want to look at that and say, that's a bunch of baloney. It's really, but I'm not sure. In the beginning, there was this sort of communal shamanistic thing about getting together with your friends and sharing that experience where you were altering your consciousness in a way that none of us who grew up in the 50s had ever done before. So that was an epiphany on some levels. Now, did it have lasting effects? I guess in some way, I guess it probably did, because it was certainly an important part of the experience. I didn't like LSD that much for a couple of reasons. And one of the reasons was I could never play when I was high because I watched my hands and it upset me to see that my fingers were turning into snakes and stuff like that. and it also lasted too long, you know. So, but I think in the beginning, I don't, you know, this is a tough question because I'm in a normal world, I'd be a great grandfather, but I've got a 12-year-old daughter.
Oh, that's right.
She won't. No, when we talk about it, I mean, I don't go into war stories, but she knows what the recovery thing is, but I'm not sure I would encourage this for my kids, but my kids will make their decisions, you know, and they'll do what they need to do. Did all those experiences influence myself as a person and artist? I mean, I'd be hard put to say how, but I cannot deny that undeniably in some way, yes. Did that make any sense whatsoever?
It absolutely did. I was going to say that even if your children chose to do drugs, there's no way they could do drugs in 1967.
No, there can't. And one of the things, one of the conversations that we have with the kids. Well, my son's a young man now, so he's not going to have these kind of conversations with me anymore. But with my daughter, I mean, I took her to the museum at Bethel up in Woodstock last summer when she was going to summer camp. And she was sort of excited by it because it's a good museum, the visuals and the stuff like that. But all she could read, the takeaway that I got from her was, "Dad, I can't believe you went out dressed like that." I mean, there's no way that she could really apprehend the sense of cultural unity that all of us of that age felt in those moments.
Well, you looked, you pulled it off. I wanted to dress just like you.
Right. Well, thank God bell bottoms have gone away. That's all I can say.
Well, you guys had a lot of style.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, and it was so cool. And you guys, you talk a lot about the albums, but talk a little bit about the gigs.
The gig thing, I love playing live. That's one of the things I think that I loved way more than my studio experience. Well, I love that too, but the playing live thing, you know, that working without a net that live music sort of entails has always really appealed to me. In the beginning, when the airplane first toured, the rock and roll shows of those very early 60s eras were not the Fillmores. We're not the Winterlands. We're not the Isle of Wight or Networth or any of that kind of stuff. You could be in a rock and roll tour with like six other bands, and your set could be like 35 minutes long. And that's just kind of how it was, you know. In the beginning, you went on the road. If you were lucky, you got a job maybe at Mother Blues in Chicago, and you played there for 2 weeks. Just like people who came to San Francisco and played the Matrix for a week or two. But then things began to mutate as the counterculture, or whatever you want to call that sort of like headspace in the 60s, began to evolve, where we needed a larger venue so you could get that communal experience that the psychedelic dance thing gave people. And once that started to happen, you know, straight, quote-unquote, straighter bands who might not have played venues like that before, they didn't really exist, but look forward to playing them also. But I think the evolution of the gigs, you know, moving from clubs or bars into the sort of dance hall and subsequently theater situation was unbelievable. And, of course, now we kind of take that stuff for granted. Like, if you're lucky, you get to play a performing arts center or a nice little restored theater. You know, and if you're playing a bar, that's good, too. I mean, we do all kinds of stuff. But the little theaters we get to play all the time are just awesome. Those didn't exist back then.
You guys played bars. You played wherever.
Oh, absolutely. I still play bars.
Well, the first time I saw you with Hot Tuna was here in Santa Cruz, actually in my little town of Aptos. You played at Cabrillo College. This was in 1975.
Oh, yeah. It was right down. Yeah, it was right.
And you were you played intensely as though you were playing at Madison Square Garden.
Well, before I get to the dancers, yeah, because we always did. However, yeah, I remember, actually, fun, strangely enough, I remember that Cabrillo College date because I'm trying to think if I had my 55 Chevy or my 34 Buick, or one of the old cars that I had. I remember it actually ran and got me down and back. That was always a big deal back then. but yeah, I mean, as far as the playing is concerned, Jack and me and my buddies, we just loved that playing live. And I mean, any time you're on stage, it could have. I mean, that was the deal. Nothing was more important than that moment.
The other thing I think is interesting about your Jefferson Airplane career is that because of the way people listen to music now, they don't put on albums like they used to, and a lot of people get their music from streaming services, Spotify, or whatever. And if you even ask them to play 60s music, then they're going to play you. You might hear, I mean, a lot of your contemporaries, like the Lovin' Spoonful or the Mamas and the Papas or whoever,
right?
They had singles. They had a bunch of hit songs. And as you point out in your book, other than Somebody to Love and White Rabbit, the Airplane don't have any songs like that.
No, you're absolutely right. And yeah, I mean, you know, back in the old days, you know, when we'd get an album, like when I got the Aretha album, I listened to that one album from start to finish, that one with Respect on it.
Right.
Over and over. And I needed to listen to the whole album because the content was just like Sgt. Pepper. Of course, that was architected that way. But I mean, the whole flow from song to song. And ultimately, after you listened to it for a while, you had your favorite songs. But at the beginning, you needed to grasp the whole thing. And you know, we'd listen to albums from start to finish. And it's one of the things, you know, that my 12-year-old daughter, she does all this stuff online and listens a lot. She listens to a lot of good music. But that album experience is alien to her.
And as a result, I don't think people would ever hear anything off of Bark or Long John Silver. Those are records that didn't have any songs that people clung to, even though those are some really fine work on those records.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Now, I remember when the Airplane... We did our somewhat ill-fated reunion in 89. Excuse me. One of the things that I think that affected what did or didn't happen on that trip was we didn't have a string of hits in order to recreate. You know, I mean, a classic example to me of being able to do that is what the Eagles do. I mean, the Eagles had more hits than Carter has with liver pills, you know. So when they get together to do their string of hits, they've got a lot of hits. You know, whether you like the Eagles or not, you got to respect that. I mean, that's impressive stuff. But that's not the Airplane. So if you're an Airplane fan, then you'll know some weird song off of Long John Silver. Play that song or whatever. But most of the fans will, what is that music anyway?
And that's kind of sad, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it is. But a lot of it has to do with just the way that people listen to music in general, I think, whether it's the streaming stuff we take for granted today, or people that listen to more quote-unquote mainstream music, you know, 40-some years ago. The Airplane, I think, encouraged a lot of... We were a good live band. You know, we talked about the live band thing. The Airplane was a passionate live band also. And so a lot of our fans who listened to us play live went and got the records and tried to get the same energy back from the records, you know. And on the good recording, they were able to do that. But otherwise, they never would have known about some of those songs on Long John Silver because they weren't getting airplay.
And even when you guys played White Rabbit and Somebody to Love, you didn't play them the way they're played on the record.
Oh no, they mutated shamelessly over the years.
Which I was always happy to hear. In fact, that recording I was thinking about, that performance at Woodstock, I think you're playing one of those, and doesn't sound like the record.
You know, and to me also, that's a good thing too. And you know, to bring things into the present, one of the things that Jack and I are eternally grateful for is that people that like Hot Tuna will come to see us play, and we're fortunate that it's not just it's mostly people of a certain age, but it's not just we get younger people that are interested in playing anyway. Our fans over the years have allowed us to mutate or grow, whatever you want to, you know, whatever adjective you want to ascribe to our music. We don't need to recreate us from, you know, the Cabrillo College in 1975. And that would be, I mean, some people are good at that kind of stuff, but we're always learning stuff. Things are always changing. Now, do things always change for the better? No, they don't. Sometimes we'll mess with something and then we'll go, you know, we might want to backtrack on this one a little bit. But all that being said, people that come to hear us play let us do that, and that's a good thing.
That's right. I mean, you could go see Hot Tuna, and it would be an acoustic, quiet, folky thing, and then you could go see them, and they'd be a power trio, and it'd be loud.
Right.
And that was part of the fun of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And for us, too, absolutely.
And you really, you talked earlier, you said you weren't a songsmith, but I mean, you've written a lot of fabulous songs and you really developed as a songwriter. How did that come about?
Well, what I mean by that is that I don't, you know, I have a lot of Nashville friends who write songs for a living. And so they're writing songs hoping that some big star will record them and make them a bunch of money. I mean, that's what I mean by a tunesmith. I've always written things that something happened in life that kicked me in the butt or some sort of divine inspiration or whatever you want to call it. And so I remember, I think the first, the first song I ever wrote was Embryonic Journey, which I wrote in 62 or 63. But I think, I mean, I never wrote lyrics before. Everybody in the airplane, and we had all these great songwriters, Paul, Marty, and Grace, and they all encouraged me to give it a shot. And as a result of that, you know, even though I hardly wrote, I didn't write a lot of songs back in those days, but whatever I wrote, I always got one on the record. In any case, I found that I really enjoyed writing songs, and if I took the advice that I give my songwriting students in classes, I would have written a lot more of them, because for better or worse, I tend to be deadline-driven. So unless some inspiring event has kicked me in the butt, I usually wait till I have a project before I settle down to write songs. But over the years, I've written a lot of songs, and I really like doing it. I really enjoy it. And my friend Chris Smith, a great singer-songwriter, one of the things he says that I love is, I hate writing songs. I like having written songs. And I don't completely subscribe to that, but on some level, I get it.
Your book, Been So Long, My Life in Music, Guillermo Gokunin, you really confront a lot of things about yourself, and that must have been difficult. Was writing this book a difficult experience?
Well, when I got into doing it, and I talked to my wife about this too, because I realized for it to be the book that I hoped it would be, I would have to be able to confront myself and my demons, and it's not all about demons. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff happened to me too, but we've all got them. And I found that as I got into the process, I became utterly self-conscious about that. Maybe that has something to do with being in recovery. I don't know. I'm not qualified to comment on that. But it was good for me. Now, I didn't. It wasn't important to me to tell war stories or, you know, a drunk log or a drug log, any of that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, I'm not the only person that's done stupid stuff and gotten into recovery. But I really wanted to be able to, in an unselfconscious and honest way, be able to tell the story of my life as it was important to me. Now, that being said, one of the criticisms that I get from people every now and then is, that I didn't talk enough, I didn't dish any dirt on Grace or Janice or any of this kind of stuff. And that's their story. That's not for me to say. And if they persist, if they become obnoxious about it, then I say, write your own book.
Well, okay.
But I say it with a smile on my face because listen, I wrote what I wrote, and I'm really good with it. And I don't feel that I need to defend it to anybody. But in terms of your question about, yes, I guess in the beginning I started out, how am I going to say this? You know, what's it going to be like when my kids read this? And I realized it's just got to be honest, you know. I mean, I don't really get into war stories because everybody's got them. That's not important. But I tried to be as honest as possible.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro here on KSCO. And tonight we're talking with guitarist Jorma Kaukinen. Well, let me follow up on a couple of things that I wanted to know about. When you left the Jefferson Airplane, you say in the book that you just basically, you know, walked away and didn't show up.
Right, pretty much.
Didn't anybody ever call and say, Jorma, are you coming in?
You know, the people that would know this have passed away since then. You know something? I don't think so. And that shows that I wasn't the only dysfunctional person in the family, you know. I mean, like, you know, Jack and I have talked about this, you know, and had I, were that happening today, I probably would have, you know, from a business point of view, go, look, guys, I think I'm done. Let's do a farewell tour and make some money, But I didn't say that. I just walked away and didn't come back. And I don't remember anybody ever actually coming to me and saying, are you coming back? I mean, Paul and me, as soon as Jack and I didn't show up, Paul took off with a starship. So So all of us, I think, in the airplane family, without putting words in people's mouths that can't, that are here to either deny them or say you got it right, we just kind of like took the next step, whatever that step was, and didn't do a lot of things that would have made sense to other people. I mean, from a business point of view, because the airplane was such a business then, it's like, you know, Yoma, we've got a year's worth of gigs, but that never happened.
Well, of course, one of the legacies of the Beatles' breakup of the Beatles was it was kind of the era of the solo album. I mean, everybody had a solo album, including you and Crosby, Stills and Nash, and Kiss.
Right.
Everybody, all the members of Kiss had solo albums.
I remember Kiss Unplugged.
But is there a feeling that? You know, when you were listening to those records, did you listen to them? Did you hear Manhole? And I don't know what role you played, if you had any part of that one. But did you listen to those
records?
No, I did.
You know, because we were all working in the same studio, I recall being in the building and in the room where some of the stuff was being cut. But I never really listened to it because I was more interested in more, for lack of a better word, rootsy or Americana music, even though everything that we've all done now has become Americana music.
That's right.
But it blows against the Empire, you know, for some reason. I think I might be on it, but I can't really remember. I mean, you know, we didn't turn into enemies. We didn't hate each other. We just, our band personas has changed.
And, of course, there was no avoiding Jefferson Starship. They were huge.
Oh, no, absolutely. And, you know, and my gag about this is I always quit the band right before it gets really successful. They were huge, absolutely.
It was a very different band, a very different sounding band, for sure. Airplane could not have recorded Miracles, I don't think.
No, absolutely not. I mean, the Starship, I mean, you know, to Paul and Grace and Marty's credit, you know, they moved ahead and they turned into a hit-making machine, and my hat's off to them for that, you know. But I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have played any of those guitar parts. It's just not the way I play. And they couldn't have had those hits. I don't think they could have had those hits with... In the airplane context, I agree with you.
Well, we've talked a lot about your old music, but I mean, you've continued to make music and make a living as a musician all these years.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, and from you know, for your listeners that are young musicians that wonder about what the future might or might not hold in store for them, all I can say is what I told my daughter when we got our Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. Look what happens when you follow your dream. I mean, you just never know what's going to happen. And me and Jack, because we're still playing together, have been the luckiest guys in the world. We've been able to do this for well more than half a century. I mean, how many artists can actually say that, you know? Why is it? I don't know. I'd like to think it's because Jack and I are good players, but there's a lot of good players out there. I believe we're really honest in what it is that we do and say. But again, you know, if we knew what the deal was, we'd bottle it and sell it.
Of course. So what do you do with your time these days? You play shows at your home. You travel around. You make records.
Sure. Well, one of my friends that's sort of my age who's been retired for a while, he always wants to do stuff with me, want to do this, do that. And I'm always going, I got stuff at the ranch, I got to do this, I'm taking my daughter, I'm playing a gig, I got to... And he doesn't get it. And I go, listen, for me to be able to function at the level that I can still function and do what I've loved all my life and still, you know, interact with my family, stuff like that, I mean, that's unbelievable. My last couple of years have been busier than any time in my life ever. I'm either touring or teaching and playing at the ranch. I mean, I did take like a month and a half off this summer because I wanted to spend some time with my wife and daughter before my daughter became a full-fledged teenager and couldn't stand to be around her parents anymore, you know. I mean, you know the deal. But you know, my life is busy, and to me, that's a good thing.
I want to ask you about religion. I was surprised to learn that you were Jewish.
I am.
And I want to know if you're more Jewish now. Did you raise your children as Jews?
Well, my daughter's being raised as a Jew in a very, very liberal kind of way. I mean, I live in Southeast Ohio, and if it weren't for the university and the Hillel, which caters to the students, the Jewish students on campus,
you'd be the only Jew there.
I'd be the only Jew here, absolutely. I think that, you know, for me, I'm not a horribly observant Jew, but I enjoy the comfort when I get together with my friends from the community at high holidays, people that I normally don't see. When I am around, I like to go to Shabbat services, you know. For me, I guess I'm not fond of dogma, and Judaism, like any religion, has its dogma. But you can't participate unless you know some of the magic words, you know. So to me, the process of learning a little bit of Hebrew, like my wife was converting and stuff like that, it's because I was raised with my maternal grandparents most of the time, who were very, very Jewish but not observant. I feel comfortable surrounded by Judaica, if that makes any sense whatsoever. And, of course, my grandmother and my mother's cooking, as always, was always important to me. I just took it for granted. I didn't realize that we were having, you know, Jewish style food. And so one of my favorite stories, if I've already told you this story, and I'm repeating myself to shut me up, but one of my best friends growing up was from, his family's from Northern Virginia. And when I'd go down and spend some time at his ancestral home, and everybody would have these big cookouts, and a potato salad wasn't made the way my grandmother did, and I'd talk about it. What's up with this potato salad? My friend's mother would be horrified. And I realized later, my grandmother's potato salad was Jewish potato salad.
That's right. But you don't find a lot of Jewish food in Ohio, do you?
Well, not down where I live. I mean, if you go to Columbus, interestingly enough, Huntington, West Virginia is about 70 miles from here, has a large Jewish community. Beautiful synagogue, and you can actually get some Jewish food there. And there's a Katzinger's in Columbus is a kosher deli, and it's like being in New York.
Well, how did you end up in Ohio and not New York or San Francisco?
Right. Well, Vanessa and I, we were living in Woodstock in the late 80s, and this friend of mine who I'd known from South Florida from decades before just called me up out of the blue. He offered me 126 acres in Meigs County, which is adjacent to Athens County, where my daughter goes to school, for $32,000. And it just seemed like a really good idea. It seemed like money well spent. It seemed like a good idea. So I bought this piece of property that was in the middle of the woods, has a little river through it, and hills and all this kind of stuff. We're in the Appalachian foothills. And Vanessa, my wife, thought I'd lost my mind. She was horrified by the thought that she would have to live in a rural part of Ohio. However,
like an episode of Green Acres.
Yeah, exactly. However, we've been there for almost 30 years now. We're at the Chamber of Commerce. And, you know, it's not just a rural backwater in a Midwestern state, because thanks to the university in Athens, there's a lot of international cool stuff going on.
Well, this book, it's called Been So Long, My Life and Music, written by my guest, Yermak Kalkin. It's one of the great rock and roll memoirs. It's one of the great books of all time. And,
oh, thank you, man. Thank you very much.
And thanks so much for spending some time talking to me on From the Bookshelf.
Well, listen, you know, I'm biting my tongue here. What I'm trying to say is I do a lot of these interviews. And I wanted to thank you, because the onus of a good interviewer is on the interviewer. And you've been fun to talk to. That makes it fun to me, and that, to me, that makes for a great interview.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.